yes, Horace Silver, the Horace Silver Quintet. Horace Silver, of course, on piano with Sister Sadie. It's from his 1959 album, Break City. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we started a little late today, but this is how we try to accommodate our fellow broadcasters. They sometimes have to go a little longer than they normally do, and we just try to accommodate that as best we can. Well, what are we talking about today? I know if I say the name Charles Ortel, you will have a clue. Charles Ortel is with us today to update us on his most recent findings and his most recent report presented here to you exclusively regarding the Clinton Foundation. As you know, as you recall, Charles Ortel has been with us from the very beginning. We've gone a long way together, and we've been concentrating on the foundation. And of course, I do not have nearly the credentials that he has in the field of finance. He is now retired. He has been retired from as a Wall Street banker who has devoted his entire time since then to forensically looking at fraud in the corporate world and in the institutional world. And when we say institutional, particularly referring to the Clinton Foundation. So just to refresh your memory, Charles Ortel was the person who essentially brought down GE, exposing on Wall Street generally, but GE in particular, exposing massive fraud and the overvaluing of stock and general bad behavior on the part of many corporations. With regard to GE, that was the specific charge, and he proved it. Look how many years have passed, and now people are still unearthing the seminal fact that he had exposed back in 2007 and 8. So now we come to the Clinton Foundation, which is a switch for him. He's now into the world of charity fraud. And at the top of his list has been the Clinton Foundation. We've reported several aspects of his findings, and they appear to be smack on what the Clintons are doing, what they have done, how they have skirted the law and have been permitted to do so. And the level of wrongdoing, as Charles Ortel has found, is in the billions, that's with a B, billions of dollars. The Clintons found a neat idea, and their idea was to organize a so-called charity, which is a nonprofit organization, and then later they added other offshoots to it, other spin-offs to it, different projects, but all under the umbrella of the Clinton Foundation. Through these entities, they were able to solicit and or receive major donations, as they call them, donations to these various charities. And we have explained to you how the money was routed, if you wish to say it that way, through these conduits, but in the end were just a massive money-making machine and formula for the Clintons. They have escaped prosecution so far, but we have indications that that may be coming to an end pretty soon, because there have been many detailed and painstaking probes into the Clinton Foundation and its operations all over the world. And the same tactic seems to be applicable. These entities are shown to be doing one thing, which technically you can say it's a charitable organization, but really what it is doing is raising a lot of money, much of it unaccounted for. For example, in Haiti, we have $10 million still missing from a rebuilding effort after the earthquake in 2010. So here we are today with Charles and his latest report. Hey, Charles, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Yatrice. Thanks for having me back on.
How is your show going? I see that you're getting better and better results in terms of subscribers and viewers. Tell us a bit about that. Let's start off with a little plug for you. I would be remiss if I don't do that.
Well, thanks so much. There's a fellow called Jason Goodman, who is NYU Film School graduate in his mid-40s, who is a Hollywood veteran. And he decided a number of years ago to create something called Crowdsource the Truth, which is a novel way of encouraging viewers to do more than just listen, watch, but to actually help in exposing the truth and reaching out to government people and reaching out to media, et cetera, and helping us with social media. So from a start, really a standing start in June of 2017, we have Jason and I, and he does many other shows, but we have done 139 two-hour podcasts, and now we typically get in the first 24 hours after, you know, it's on air, we typically get about 10,000 views, which is very long, actually, a large viewership for a long podcast. And it's through that process that we pitch the podcast to investigators. We try to save government officials, states, you know, federal government, foreign governments. We try to save them time, and we point them to the sources. People always wonder, you know, how do we come up with this or that? We point them to the hard evidence that's all in the public domain, and we believe, Jason and I and our colleagues believe, that this is really taking root here. And it is a massive problem. And thank you, Yatrice. I mean, you let me begin covering this, I think it was in May of 2016 with you. And through all the work we've done together and now this additional work, more and more people see this for what it is. It is the largest unprosecuted set of charity frauds in history. I was listening to the tail end of the previous hour, and somebody was casting aspersions about the capitalist system and the profit-seeking. One thing that's kind of interesting about the profit-seeking world is that the people who get involved in it all care a lot. They want profit, and they don't want to see profit stolen. So on the other hand, in the not-for-profit world, when you take away that motive, and then you fail to appreciate that the flows of money that go around the world, particularly to things like this Clinton Foundation, are impossible to trace. And the people involved with these charities, many are cynical, but most of them tend to be not cynical enough. So when dynastic political families, and it's not just the Clintons, I think the Obamas may be doing the same thing, and then the Bushes and others, when these dynastic political families attach themselves to a charity and then ensure that the charity is not, in fact, independent from the family, which it's required to be, you can't set up a presidential foundation like this Clinton Foundation and say it's controlled by the Clinton family. That's strictly forbidden, but that's indeed what they've done. So when you break the rules, when you put inside trustees or political sycophants and supplicants, and major donors to whatever party it may be, whatever campaigns it might be, with major benefits to be gotten through financing ne'er-do-wells like the Clintons, who had, from a financial perspective, nothing until
well,
they
let's
left.
Let's start with this question that I will ask you. What is the newest angle that... I know there's a lot that we can talk, but we have to break it up in subsequent programs. So we'll take a little at a time, because I believe in doing the job thoroughly. So in this installment, where will you be taking us?
Okay. Well, what I can take you through is, you know, I've been on this now. This is completed in a little while here. This will be 4 years of work on this. So I've got a lot of notes, a lot of information, a lot to digest. And I'm now going back over ground that I plowed really 4 years ago, but with the benefit of 4 years of research. So I see details now that I missed before. And what is a gold mine here? It's really interesting when you look at charities. What's a gold mine is that charities the size of the Clinton Foundation have to make public disclosures which cannot be hidden. And so there's a tremendous amount of information already in the public domain that I believe, first of all, it should indict the trustees of the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton family, major donors, for starters. But beyond that, should also indict insiders in the FBI and the IRS and elsewhere who certainly, you know, because the record does show, certainly should have been in a position to spot this fraud, but for some reason they let it go. They gave it a pass. And one thing that was particularly useful, I contacted, there's a portion of the FBI that runs something called the FBI Vault, and that's an online resource that is available to anybody around the world. You can go on for free. You can see what's in the FBI Vault. Well, there's a file in the FBI Vault it was a three-part file, William J. Clinton Foundation, three parts. The third part came out in recent months, but the first part came out on November 1st, 2016, so just as the election was you know, nearing between Hillary and Trump. And then there's also a document called the DIOG, which is the Domestic Investigations Operations Guide. And, you know, it's a two-part document. It's online, the 2013 version, the 16 version. And the first section, the first volume is, I think, 457 pages long. And it takes you through the rationale for how the FBI, you know, should conduct an investigation, the different types of investigation. And the investigation that we're talking about in regards to this Clinton Foundation back that was started, you see, it was started February 15th, 2001. And in parts one and two, and in most of part three, they black out the name of one of the targets. And one of them was definitely Bill Clinton, and they say, you know, former president of the United States. But consistently, except on page 138, if I just was going over these notes, page 138 of part three, it says, it reveals who this blacked out, you know, the potential defendant was. And it was none other than Hillary Clinton. So Hillary Clinton, sworn into office as a U.S. senator on January 3rd, 2001, and she couldn't even make it to, you know, one day past Valentine's Day 2001 without becoming, you know, the target of an FBI public corruption investigation. And, I mean, if you start going into this, and then there's entries in this file where they talk about, you know, immediately, February 15th, they open an investigation. And in contrast to what happens under James Comey, when the Clinton Foundation matter resurfaces in 2015, immediately teams are created in New York and Washington, D.C., field office and White Plains. They go over to Bern, Switzerland, and London, England, and they go to Los Angeles and Rochester, and starting to sound like Howard Dean. Sorry about that. And they, you know, they go, they're scurrying, and grand juries are convened, and witnesses are subpoenaed and interviewed and all this kind of stuff. And there's an entry that says, you know, we expect to have many thousands of pages of information. This is by mid-March 2001. Well, in the public domain, the one thing that is not present, that I, in all the years I've been on this now, there is not a single required, and you need to have this. If you don't have it, then your tax returns are not complete. You haven't filed your taxes. There is not an audit, financial audit, for the Clinton Foundation until 2002, March of 2002. And that audit is false, materially misleading, and not done in accordance with what are called generally accepted accounting principles in the United States of America. And so therefore, it is not a real audit. It is a fake audit. Now, you look through these notes of the FBI, their information, it's on their site. How could this crack team, it's like 20-plus people, how could they miss the facts? They note that the Clinton Foundation was a foundation established to support the Clinton Presidential Library. That's what they say in two places that I see in part one. I think in early March 2001, the internal files of the FBI prove that the FBI understood that the Clinton Foundation was supposed to be something to support the library in Little Rock. And that's it. None of this HIV/AIDS stuff, none of this climate change stuff, none of the Clinton Global Initiative, none of that was authorized. Here's an FBI team moving and shaking and working hard on it until what happens? June 25th, 2001, Louis Freeh leaves. Okay, and then in abeyance, they have the acting director of the FBI, Thomas J. Picard. He's there until Robert Mueller shows up on September 4th, 2001. And, of course, the dread events of September 11th intervene. But U.S. investigation never takes off, even though it had thousands of pages prior to September 4th. Mueller then heads up the FBI. And who takes over from Mary Jo White to look into, to lead from the DOJ standpoint, what's going on in this targeting of the Clinton Foundation for public corruption, to target Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton? Who takes that over? James Comey. Who's in charge of the IRS? The Justice Department of prosecuting tax frauds? Rod Rosenstein. So here you have, you know, in the important history, it's a very important context. Here you have, at the core of this unresolved Clinton Foundation fraud, three people who are now definitely involved starting in 2016 to present in going after possible Russian collusion and other things. But these are the same three people who missed the Clinton Foundation, in quotes, missed the Clinton Foundation fraud. And, you know, to me, it's just, I'm not a lawyer, but there's just such an obvious, you know, conflict here between the way in which things relating that are, you know, noxious frauds that have escalated to place a stain, a growing stain on the international, on the integrity of the United States justice system. You know, these three gentlemen, you know, I can't have it the way they have it. They missed this thing. The Clinton thing explodes. It's still a continuing fraud, in my view. On the other hand, they give Hillary Clinton a complete pass on mishandling, classified information. I mean, it's just the contrast is so stark here. And for the good of us all, you know, let's set our political differences aside, you know, for a second and just say we want a justice system that truly is blind. We don't want a system where the word spreads out to candidates. You know, when you get in as attorney general or whatever, president, you get to tear up the Constitution or you get to enforce the Constitution strictly or you get to do something else. That's not the way the system works, because then suddenly should work, because then suddenly we go right down the path to tyranny.
Now, you have been doing a forensic analysis of this fraud. You called it the largest unprosecuted fraud in U.S. history, and possibly just history, period. Could we, for the moment, just give people a working idea of how much money constituted this fraud?
Sure. So for starters, you know, just a brief bit of background. When you set up a charity, it's not like setting up a typical business when you can say, and I'm not really sure what I want to do in the media business. I'm just going to set up a company. And today I say I want to be an internet broadcaster, and tomorrow I may want to own a car wash chain. I mean, you could do that in business, but you can't do that when you are saying that you're a charity where your donors get to deduct donations against their personal income, reducing their personal income tax bill, and where you get to keep and reinvest inside the charity the difference between your revenues and your expenses without paying any tax on that. The government says you've got to be really specific. You got to give us an application. Tell us what you're going to do. We have to decide that what you're talking about is actually a charity. And if you want to change even a small bit of what you're doing, you got to ask our permission in advance. You just can't say, today, I want to be a library holding the presidential records of the Clinton Foundation in Little Rock. And then let's say along the way, just as Bill's leaving the White House, you can't say, well, I think what I'll do is I'll buy some property in Hot Springs, Arkansas, that Bill and his brother and his cousins appear to have had an interest in with the money we raised to build the foundation in Little Rock before we've even started breaking ground in Little Rock. You can't do something like that normally, but they did do something like that. We did something exactly like that in 2000, 2001. So you can't change, and you can't without getting IRS approval in advance. And you also can't say, you know, today I'm going to do something in Little Rock, and tomorrow I'm going to chase rainbows around the African continent and Australia and India and everywhere else, fighting climate change and doing all this kind of stuff. That's a radically different thing. And you're not supposed to raise money, solicit money even, without collecting a dime. You're not supposed to solicit for one cause and then use the proceeds for a different cause. You're absolutely not allowed to raise money in the guise of charity and then use it to feather your personal nest, whether to pay for your, you know, one mansion up in Chappaqua or the other one down in Washington, D.C., or personal living expenses or political campaigns. You are strictly forbidden from doing that. You're strictly forbidden, that is to say, we, you and I, you, Therese, and the listeners here, the laws are strict. You're not allowed to do any of that. And yet, I would argue from the very get-go, from October 23rd, 1997, when Bill was president, he knew he was president. He knew he had his people in at Justice and the IRS and everywhere else. He had trouble in the House and the Senate, but he got through that. And he knew he had it wired. His people just said they were raising money for the charity. There was no check on it, no independent trustees. All the trustees were political hacks. And there's no audit of the finances while he was in president. So nobody really knows how much money was raised. Then the FBI opens the investigation February 15th, 2001. And for 4 years, even under the George W. Bush presidency, the FBI in theory is investigating it, but no one notices. There's just no audits. They're not compliant. They're not reporting material defects in the organization. And then when they start getting away with all that, they raise their sights. Instead of raising money just for this library complex, which was in theory finished around November 18th, 2004, when arrangements were made to, legal arrangements were concluded with the National Archives, they basically achieved their stated purposes on November 18th, 2004, thereabouts. So did that stop them? Ordinarily, when you set up a charity and you say, I'm raising money to put up a building, a complex in Little Rock, to store these records. Well, when you finish that, you're done. You turn, the responsibility for running the place over to the National Archives. And if you want to do something different, normally you have to go and say, all right, I want to do something different. Well, they never amended the stated purposes of the charity. And then they continued charging around the world almost from the first week that Bill left the White House. After he left the White House, he started, raising money in the name of his charity for causes that had nothing to do with the charity. And he never actually physically, there's no evidence that he ever became a named trustee or executive or whatever, but he started signing legal agreements all around the world with governments to do this project, that project, yet another project. And then flew around the world with, donors who have interest before the U.S. government and other governments. And, these people were very happy to give small money to Bill Clinton and get large favors, either from the U.S. government or foreign governments or whatever. And then, he began this process, it would seem, the public record shows, of he'd take it a step further. They worked hard, the people around the Clintons and others, to create this thing called the Global Fund, as one example. And that Global Fund, I did the math recently, in the 16 years or 17 years for which there are records, that Global Fund has raised $40 billion for projects around the world. And then when you look into it, of course it's part of the UN system, so it's not really regulated or checked by anybody. But knowledgeable people who've been into that Global Fund alleged that as much as two-thirds to three-quarters of all the money that has been raised has been stolen. And the way that happens is the Global Fund makes a grant to a country, but how do you check what the country's really going to do with it? You know, a Global Fund makes a grant to a large charity. How do you check that the charity is really doing what, you know, so there's no real way to check any of this. But people who've been into the mess, seen the fraud firsthand, in country by country, come away and say, look, you could assume that two-thirds, maybe three-quarters of the money in the Global Fund, you know, and organizations like it. You have something called UNAIDS, UNITAID. You could go on and on and on. The World Health Organization with their various grants. There's no oversight of it. So here we are in America and across these nations that are, you know, where people are stressing out, France, Italy, Germany, Canada, all these nations where we're having trouble, we're piling up debt, you know, and our citizens are struggling to keep their jobs and to pay their bills, and now they're suffering from inflation, whatever. Meanwhile, these, what I call them, the 13 crackberry Davos men and women, they run around the world, you know, urgently always late for another appointment with some grand promise asking for billions of dollars, securing the knowledge that no one's ever going to check to see what happened to the money. And, you know, when you're running from one conference in Caracas to another one in Poland and then over to Los Angeles and, you know, back down to Australia or whatever, the authorities can never keep track of all that. And
I want to ask, well, you gave us an insight in one specific example, and the total that you come up with in this one situation is $40 billion. With a B, $1 billion,
yeah.
Still unaccounted for. Now, how, what would you say, what is a decent estimate? Because they haven't filed any reports on the money that they either received or were given or solicited. What kind of money are we talking about here?
Okay, well,
in total, an estimate.
Right, so, sure, sure. If we start narrowly with it, there are several Clinton foundations. So if we just talk first about them, you're talking about, they claim they raised about $3 billion for them. Okay, they also claim in the literature that the Little Rock complex cost $165 million. Now, you know, call me a skinflint, but if you come to me and you say, hey, Charles, I need $165 million for the complex in Little Rock, and when I do that, I'll achieve my goal, and then, you know, I kind of forget about it and get your $165 million, and then 15 years later, somebody says, hey, Charles, didn't you give them $165 million to do a Little Rock? Yeah, yeah. And, you know, they raised $3 billion, right? So, what? How do you raise $3 billion for a project that should have cost $165 million? And I don't even think $165 million is a fair estimate of what it actually costs. I would guess it's more like $85 to $100 for the complex. So what do they need the other $2.9 billion? And how come nobody in our IRS, nobody in the Department of Justice, nobody in the Attorney General's Office of Arkansas, none of the accounting firms that looked at this, stopped to ask the question, wait a minute, you're telling me you raised $3 billion for a project that said was going to cost $165 million. What happened to the $2.8 billion, $2.835 billion? What happened to that money? You know, and nobody's going to, you can write all these fancy, long and 300-page reports about some project they did in rural Lesotho or Mozambique or India or whatever. It goes on and on and on with Harvard and Yale and MIT and all sorts of big, fancy professors putting their names on these reports. Nobody asks a simple question. You're supposed to be doing stuff only in Little Rock. How can you have an office in New York and Boston and all across Africa and India and Australia and Papua New Guinea? What the hell is this all about? And so you then start thinking about the projects they get involved with that, where they lend their names. So you mentioned Haiti. And, you know, Haiti is a place, as it turns out, I went back over my notes recently, that Bill first started doing projects in Haiti in the name of the Clinton Foundation in 2003. There's no authority for the Clinton Foundation to do work in Haiti in 2003. And when you go into that time frame, and you know the history of Haiti much better than I do, Eutrice, Haiti was in dire straits right around then. That's when Aristide was removed in 2004. You know, what the hell was Bill Clinton?
Bill had them removed. It was Bill who had it removed.
Right. Okay. Well, what the hell was he doing down in Haiti in 2003, flying around in the name of the Clinton Foundation? Then you check the financial statements of the Clinton Foundation for 2003. The crucial expense item of a foundation is what are called program service expenses. That's what, you know, you say you're supposed to do, you know, the programs in your application for federal tax exemption on Form 1023. You describe those programs, and then you're supposed to tell the IRS how much money you spent in furtherance of those tax-exempt purposes. Those are called program service expenses. They typically are 85% of your total expenses, where the balance should be overhead. Well, you look at 2003, the report for 2003, and it's radically different than 2002 and radically different than 2004. And the program service expense, the biggest element of it, is called special projects. They don't explain what those special projects are. Probably had something to do with Haiti and maybe Mozambique and Rwanda and Tanzania fighting AIDS. None of that stuff is approved, but they have the genius idea to just say, well, okay, we shouldn't be doing this, so what we'll do is we'll just call it a special project and we won't explain it. And our IRS and our FBI says, well, that's okay. You're the Clintons. You do what you want. You know, so you get to Haiti, you're starting out meddling around there in 2003, and then, as you say, in 2010, the earthquake happens, and, you know, Bill has used the Clinton Foundation auspices to raise money in Gujarat, India, starting 2001 for an earthquake, and then the tsunami late in 4, early in 5 in East Asia, then Katrina in August of 2005. So he's got a long experience with disaster strikes. Now you see them again in Puerto Rico. You know, disaster strikes, make a global appeal for money. No one's going to check and see how much money actually comes in. And whether it's Bill or fraudsters close to Bill, somebody make sure that they're there to get them all the money. And then, since there's no accountants checking anything the way they should, no one actually knows how much money gets diverted into and why. So in that example, in the Bush-Clinton-Katrina fund, the Clinton-Bush-Haiti fund that gets created in 2010 after the earthquake, that shows total incomings of like $100 million in revenue or so. Yet, in the press accounts of how much money was raised for various projects around Haiti, some people say it was $9 billion, some people say it's $10 billion, some people say it's $13 billion. But the one thing that people across the island or the nation of Haiti say in unison is they didn't get any money, any serious amount of money. And to me, you know, it's actually not an ethnicity issue for me. It's these are vulnerable people who are living in a place that God forgot about, evidently. It used to be a rich place, and for a variety of reasons, it's not. And the people of Haiti have been suffering for a long, long time. They are our brothers and sisters in this region. And, you know, if we're going to start helping people around the world after a disaster, we better make damn sure that after the disaster, we keep track of how much money actually was raised and who may have dared to steal that money and divert that money away from the people who are even worse off now in Haiti than they were after the earthquake in 2010. 9 years later, they're still in. Do you see them around New York City? I get notices from the groups of, you know, people who are protesting. Where are the missing billions of dollars that were supposed to go towards Haiti? You know, and here we have, you know, Hillary Clinton ruminating about yet another failed attempt to run for president. You know, on what skill set? On what list of accomplishments? You know, I'm down in Puerto Rico helping the people of Puerto Rico. God help the people of Puerto Rico if the Clintons are having anything to do with this. And so the one constant, sad constant in life is that natural disasters occur, you know, on a regular basis. We're not going to stop earthquakes from happening. We're not going to stop tsunamis. We're not going to stop, you know, different disasters. And when these disasters happen, good people of all backgrounds, all faiths, all persuasions, typically reach into their pockets and are quite happy, thanks to the internet, to send $5 or $20 or $100 or $1 or whatever into a number, thinking that they're helping the people who have been hurt by these natural disasters. How come our government isn't jumping up and down all over Bill Clinton for an explanation of what the hell happened in Haiti with all that money. What really happened with the tsunami relief money? What really happened with Katrina? And, you know, after these national disasters, if I were had anything to do with Congress, I would put a bill up that says the president, former president of the United States, are strictly prohibited from raising money for national disasters. Strictly prohibited, based on the record I see. And, you know, since from 2001 onward, because it's just too easy for fake charities to appear. And it's so easy to set up, you know, get a domain name, find a friendly crooked banker to open a bank account or PayPal or Western Union or something. And next thing you know, you've got a spigot, a river, a torrent of money pouring into these coffers, people thinking it's going to the starving people in Haiti down there without electricity and roads and roofs over their heads. In reality, it's going to a collection of fraudsters. We're just waiting for the next national disaster to dial it all up. And what happens? You know, occasionally the IRS makes an example of somebody like Corinne Brown, who was a congressperson who did some of this and is in prison for, I think, 4 to 5 years. They make an example of a Republican. Corinne's a Democrat. Steve Stockman, he's going to prison. But these are only, you know, $1 million frauds. They're not $10 billion frauds. They're not $40 billion or $100 billion. So when you ask the question, how much could it be, these projects, you know, Ocasio-Cortez is talking about a $33 trillion Green New Deal, you know, or a big infrastructure spending. They're just like these charity frauds. Nobody knows how much was actually stolen, wasted, diverted in the stimulus program under Obama in 2009 and 10, where Jeff Immelt, the guy you mentioned, the GE, who's the CEO of GE, took some time away from his full-time job to get involved with a project where, you know, Congress was rushed into spending $1 trillion almost, because Immelt and Obama said that there are a whole bunch of shovel-ready jobs. No shovel-ready jobs. There were no jobs. You know, and so you have these grand plans. Nobody can check them. And there's a lot of money washing around the world looking to, you know, to invest in U.S. government debt and other sovereign debt. So you can always, at this moment, you could find money for almost any project. But to date, you know, the very people who are supposed to watch this, stay on top of it in media, in Congress, the FBI, the security services, they're not doing their job, which is why I've just been relentlessly pounding on this, because it's not fair to our children, their fellow citizens. It's not fair to the people in parts of this country who really do need help for us to, you know, get ourselves involved with these projects that, you know, where there's no control of the money. Because it's just a prescription
for fraud. Raising this money from 2001 in all these different aspects, in all these different ways, for all these different purposes. One thing, of course, as you've been discussing, is the amount of money. It is a staggering amount. It's a $1 billion enterprise. It might even have gone beyond that, given that this began in 2001, and there have been so many projects that the Clinton Foundation has spawned and directed and put under its wing as affiliated programs that independently were soliciting funds.
Right.
So that is one thing, the length of time. But we can't ignore the fact that this also might be a major conspiracy, not only at a very high level, but this involves literally a global community. If you're soliciting funds from all these international organizations, from all these different countries that are donating based on what you represent to be a charitable effort, it seems to me that there ought to be an international investigation here, people coming together saying, well, wait a minute, we gave $600 million. We have no accounting for it. Another country would say, yeah, we gave $1.5 billion. We have no accounting for it. Is it that they're just ashamed or they themselves are inept, or they're in on it. What do you suspect is happening here, that a pattern established in 2001 still persists in 2019?
Well, I think you've hit on it. I mean, I think if you think about Bill Clinton as the test case, I mean, you're down there in Washington, D.C. You don't have any money to your name. You get really used to, like, you wake up in the morning and you think, well, I think I'll go over to, I'll go over to, up to New York today. And next thing you know, you've got a motorcade of, I don't know how many limousines taking you to the heliport. However you travel, and you're living in a mansion with hot and cold running butlers and chefs and maids and chauffeurs and this and that. And, you know, you've never made, until they left the White House, they've never made $1 million in a given year. You can't finance that kind of lifestyle on $1 million salary, which is a big salary. So you get used to, as a head of state of a big country, you get used to a billionaire, better than a billionaire lifestyle. There's no waiting. You don't have to go to the airport, get there 3 hours early, and then sit and, you know, get your boarding pass and wait in a line of 25 jets to take off. No, you get on Air Force One, bam. You know, the airspace is clear. You get off, you get your motorcade, and there's no lights to worry about. No, nothing. Your life is worry-free from a financial standpoint. So you get used to the super high lifestyle, and you're not alone. You know, Tony Blair has the same problem, you know, when he leaves. Or what does he do? He sets a foundation up. All these guys, they get together, men and women, they say, you know what? I'll be the president or the leader of the country, and then after that, I'll get involved with the UN, and I'll get involved with the foundation, and no one's going to check anything. So there's a community of these former leaders. And there's actually several foundations that are established. One's called the Club de Madrid. Another, I think, is called the Elders, and there's a few others that basically get these former leaders together, in theory, to work on do-gooder projects. But again, there's no tracking of these do-gooder projects. And the number of scoundrels that are associated with this is that Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel Peace Prize guy, should be ashamed of himself for the scandalous work he's doing, you know, in theory providing microcredit to these communities, these impoverished communities around the world. Again, there's no checking of any of that, and no one really knows how much money is being diverted away from these desperately poor people. So the community gets together. The projects sound wonderful. The Harvard, Yale professors, they love it. It's globalism. It's not regulated. They fly around the world. They increase the audience for their books and in their global notoriety. But, you know, at the end of every week, the poor, starving people in these countries are, you know, they don't have electricity. They don't have hospitals. They don't have doctors aren't there for them. Nurses aren't there for them. Roads aren't between the places. The cities aren't built. The dams are falling down. The railroads aren't built. Yet these professors and unregulated globalists pat themselves on the back, give themselves awards, get more honoraria, give all these speeches, and we the people fall for it because we're too trusting. And it's really, it's a bipartisan thing for me. I'm anti-fraud, and I don't care if it's Republican, Democrat, non-aligned, apolitical. You shouldn't be out there raising money on the backs of the most vulnerable people around us. And then, you know, because you get billions or tens of billions or hundreds of billions, divert that money. You absolutely should do that. And if you're going to get involved with a project like that and you're a famous person like Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, shame on you. You are responsible if money is diverted because of the star power that you've lent to the project. You can't be, you know, bothered to have some of the tough miners that generally look after you check the numbers. I mean, it's a story that has to be told. Eudrice, I appreciate the chance to come on air with you and talk about it.
Not at all. I am delighted to help. In fact, I'm going to ask you, insofar as there's so much government inaction, the government absolutely refuses to touch the subject, is there anything that citizens can do, any kind of citizen action to force investigations and to force the matter to come public?
Yeah, there certainly is. The one area would be, you know, there are a lot of lawyers and law firms who provided either paid or pro bono services to these foundations. And when you check in, and I'm not a lawyer, but I can read, and when you check the rules or regulations that pertain to the legal profession, you know, the rules say that lawyers are absolutely prohibited from engaging in deceptive, fraudulent practices. So, you know, for those lawyers who are out there who can make us think about this, you know, there are quite a few different lawyers connected to the Clinton Foundation who should be brought up on disciplinary action, should be disbarred. Then you get to the question of accounting firms. And there are many, many accounting firms that to become a certified public accountant, not like a lawyer. There's no such thing as privilege. You are actually, your duty is to, you have a duty to the public at large as a CPA to make sure that your good name and your professional skills are not used for, to cover up a fraud. So there are quite a few accounting firms that BKD is one I'd never heard of until I got into this. It's a Midwestern-based firm. The Price Waterhouse is a big firm that's lent its name to this. Cohn Resnick is a smaller firm. There are a bunch of other firms. And citizens, particularly those who hold the qualification of CPA, can make an issue of it with, you know, they can find the different audits that have been out there, look for yourselves, look at our podcast. You'll see none of the audits associated with any part of the Clinton Foundation, in my view, complies with the applicable regulations. So you start with the professions, then you contact your attorney general and say, how come the Clinton Foundation is still soliciting in my state? Most states in Washington, D.C. require you to fill out forms that are accurate to disclose your defects. The Clinton Foundation has never done that. So if you're in the United States, those are three ways. And externally, you know, the Clinton Foundation publishes the ranges of gifts from different governments. If you're in the U.K. or Australia or France or places that have given a ton of money, Norway, New Zealand, Germany, you know, contact the equivalent of our attorney general and IRS in your country. Say, tell them to watch the podcast. Why don't you care about this missing money? It's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. Well, we have to leave it here for today. But I'd like to, of course, come back next week and continue Chapter 2 in this new updated series that we should be doing on the Clinton Foundation based on Charles Ortel's scrupulous investigation and forensic work. This is not a casual endeavor. It has taken him many years of digging, and he still is digging. And we have to assist in the process of making what he has discovered known. This is, as he says, the largest unprosecuted fraud in the history of the United States. And it's not even being talked about for obvious reasons. But Charles, I thank you once again for being available to us, and we will get to questions. People are always eager to ask you questions, but the first thing I like is to prepare people based on the new information that you have or whatever information you're sharing so that they can take that information into consideration as they formulate their questions. But I want to thank you again for being available and spending such great time with us today, such profitable time, pardon the pun. But thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Yatrice. The pleasure is mine.
All righty. So that's it. We'll see each other tomorrow on Free Your Mind Friday. Bye-bye.